Hello, everyone, and welcome to Reader's Digress, the podcast where we read nonfiction books so that you don't have to, unless you want to. I'm Kate.
And I'm Molly. And today, Kate is telling me a story.
Yay! Story time. So today, I am going to tell you about the book Empire of Pain, The Secret History of the Sackler Dynasty by Patrick Rodden Keefe.
You know, chill, light, easy reading.
Light, very, very fun and silly content.
Nice, loosey-goosey. That's what silly goofy.
Yeah. 100%. I think I dropped on the podcast like a year ago that I had read this book and that I wanted to do it for the podcast. And then it took me literally a year to psych myself up enough to write the notes. Because I was like, this is so much content. Yeah. So I'm going to try my best. Okay. And if there's too much information in here, we will end up skipping over some, but we are going to get the broad strokes of the story.
Yay. I can't wait.
Okay. Let me jump into a summary that ChatGPT helped me write.
Love
Shout
it.
Out to the best love friend. It. Empire of Pain by Patrick Rodden Keefe is a meticulously researched and compelling narrative that chronicles the rise and fall of the Sackler family, otherwise known as the owners of Purdue Pharma. Purdue Pharma aggressively marketed and promoted the prescription painkiller OxyContin, contributing significantly to the widespread opioid addiction and overdoses, now often referred to as the opioid crisis or the opioid epidemic in the U.S. So the narrative of this book spans several decades, and it traces the Sackler family's ascent into the pharmaceutical industry, their development of OxyContin, and the subsequent legal and ethical challenges they faced as the opioid crisis escalated. Keefe delves into family dynamics, corporate strategies, and the consequences of Purdue Pharma's actions on individuals and communities. Empire of Pain explores the intersections of wealth, power, and morality, raising important questions about corporate responsibility and accountability. This book has been praised for its investigative depth, storytelling prowess, and its contribution to the broader understanding of the opioid crisis and its impact on American society. In 2017, Keefe published a precursor to this book in The New Yorker called The Family That Built an Empire of Pain, which gives the overview of the Sackler involvement in the opioid epidemic in a long-form article. So if you are interested in reading the shortened but still long version of this account, you can read it in The New Yorker. And then both the article and the expanded book were used as sources in the Netflix limited series that came out in 2023 called Painkiller.
Okay.
So there's a lot of content surrounding this book. You do not have to read all 600 pages of this book if you are interested in the topic and just want a bit more than this podcast will offer.
Got it. Okay.
Okay. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
Should we do like a meditation before we jump into this heavy topic? Okay. So first and foremost, I am just curious, like, how familiar are you with the Sackler family's involvement in the opioid crisis?
I mean, I know like the cliff notes, I guess, or maybe not even that much, but like, I know that they are the family that developed the like OxyContin and that they like knew how addictive and bad it was. And they were just like, we don't care. We want money.
Sure. we're going to get into that a little bit closer. But okay, that makes sense. I mostly just wanted to ask so I can decide how much or little information to give you on certain things. So you're not feeling like, yeah, I already know that. Keep it moving.
Got it.
Okay. So also one thing I want to point out is that we both grew up in Ohio, which was one of the states that was hit the hardest. Yeah. And so that will come up a couple times throughout the episode and feels like it's worth noting.
Yes, totally.
Okay. So I actually Let me talk a little bit about how I have structured my notes for this conversation. I have a really little section at the beginning where I just want to talk about the importance of this story. Mm-hmm. Then I want to talk about the Sacklers as a family. Okay. So like the individuals. Mm-hmm. And then I want to talk about the history of opium leading up to OxyContin, and then like the sales of that and abuse and legal cases that came thereafter.
Okay.
So it's sort of chronological, but in some ways not.
Okay. Yeah. It's like topical.
I'm like, it's chronological by topic.
Perfect.
Okay. So first and foremost, I think that this is one of the most important stories to understanding America today. Mm. Aside from the housing crisis and the rise of social media.
Okay, love it.
Like, I think with those three stories, it helps explain, like, I don't know, give or take 85% of our current predicament as Americans in 2024, which I think I said on the last podcast that we were still in 2023.
Whatever.
And I am realizing that it's 2024.
It's fine,
now,
it's fine.
Okay.
But I feel like this combined with our last episode is very much like everything that's wrong with America.
Yeah, 100%. Like, we have covered like 50% of American shittiness. Yeah. So, okay, I want to throw out a few statistics here to ground us in the breadth of this story. Okay. So from 1999 to 2021, over 200,000 Americans have died from overdoses related to OxyContin and other prescription opioids. Many whose addiction arose from prescription painkillers have turned to heroin because prescription painkillers can be expensive and because of the opioid crisis have become increasingly difficult to obtain.
Oh my God.
So scholars have studied that there was a sudden rise in heroin overdoses beginning in 2010. And they concluded essentially that many of the Americans who were taking heroin had started out taking OxyContin and prescription drugs.
Wow.
So there is a direct correlation between this story and heroin use in America. According to the American Society of Addiction Medicine, 4 out of 5 people, I want to repeat that, 4 out of 5 people who started using heroin during this period did so after initially abusing prescription painkillers. So we are talking about 80% of people who are using heroin are directly related back to the Sacklers' decisions.
Wow.
As the heads of Purdue Pharma.
Fuck them. Let's just say for the record.
Sincerely.
Fuck them.
Sincerely fuck these people. as a little bit of context, we'll get into this later, but within 4 years of the launch of OxyContin, they hit $1 billion in sales, surpassing the quintessential blockbuster drug of that era, which was, maybe you could guess, Viagra.
Jesus Christ. We are fucked.
And Ohio, okay, this is an important note on Ohio. Okay, by 2016, 2.3 million people in the state, approximately 20% of the total population, received a prescription for opioids.
Wow.
Half of the children who were in the foster care system across the state had opioid-addicted parents.
Ugh.
So if you feel like this was a topic that was always swirling around you as you were growing up and in your teens, it's probably true.
Yeah.
Right? Growing up in Ohio, I felt like this was something that people were always a little bit talking about. Mm-hmm. If not in like kind of a tangential way. Mm-hmm. And I think that statistic really helps to explain why, because if you are in a state where 20% of the total population has received a prescription for opioids, it's pretty prevalent, right? That's like 1 in 5 people, probably people you know, may have been prescribed opioid. And for a lot of those folks, it was for chronic pain, which meant that it was consistent.
God. Oh my God, that's so fucked.
So I just wanted to start with that because I think it's important to ground this conversation in just how widespread the influence was, how impactful the decisions that the Sacklers made were, and how many people this impacted. Okay, I can move on to talking about the Sacklers, but I wanted to pause in case you had anything to add to that or questions to ask at this point.
No, I was just processing. I think, yeah, okay, continue.
It is a lot to take in. So if at any point you're like, okay, I need a break. I feel like I'm running a marathon. It's like you're reading a paragraph. Shut the fuck up. Okay, so let's talk about the Sacklers. I want to be clear that this book, Empire of Pain, is first and foremost a story of the Sackler family. And by telling the story of the Sackler family, it also tells the story of the opioid crisis. But at no point in reading this book are you under the impression that those two histories are divorced from each other. They're continuously connected because of the influence that this family in particular had. Which is a, pretty damning indictment of this family. And I want to make it clear that the author very much feels that this particular family is in large part at fault for what has happened here. Even though they deny all responsibility and pretend that they are not.
Totally.
So this book, as I mentioned, is multi-generational. It starts with the first generation, which are three brothers: Arthur, Mortimer, what a name, and Raymond. They were Jewish immigrants from Poland, and they immigrated to New York and grew up in Brooklyn in the 1930s. All three of them went to medical school, and they were particularly interested in psychiatric disorders, which at the time were very not understood at all. And many did not actually view psychiatric disorders as biological illnesses. But the Sacklers were interested in thinking about them as a chemical imbalance. And that led them to be interested in finding chemical treatments through medicine to alleviate the symptoms that many people were facing. So this would have been at the time like pretty radical to think about it in this way, thinking about it as alternatives to like electroshock therapy or just like psychoanalysis. The first part of this story is like, okay, I'm with you. Like, all right, maybe you did have something to contribute. Until we get to the second generation and it's like, oh no, all of you are sacks of shit. These three brothers had like a goal to give back to their communities. They actually had like a pact between the three of them that they would build up their medical practice, but that none of their children would inherit the business.
Interesting.
Instead, this is a direct quote, instead, each man would be entitled to leave a reasonable sum to his heirs, and the rest would pass eventually to a charitable trust. So at the time, they were really thinking about this as something that they felt obligated to do. They felt like it was their duty to give back and to provide charitable donations to places that they felt were doing good work. We'll see later how this philosophy warps into something that's, you may guess, fucked up. But we'll get there. I will say, though, that while they had this pact, it appears that by the time that one of the brothers, the first brothers, died, they had, through some mutual agreement, decided that that was no longer the arrangement and they were going to pass it down to their kids.
Got it.
So in 1952, they bought a small pharmaceutical company called Purdue Frederick. And two of the brothers, Mortimer and Raymond, were in charge of Purdue. So they're in charge of the pharmacy. While Arthur, he had a stake in the pharmaceutical company, but he was really interested in the field of medical advertising. So He led a marketing agency and created marketing campaigns that were directed specifically at doctors to prescribe drugs to their patients, which had never really been formalized before. So this opens the gateways to a lot of very unethical behavior.
Yeah.
Their biggest drugs at the time were tranquilizers. So like Valium and Librium.
Okay.
By 1973, American doctors were writing more than 100 million tranquilizer prescriptions per year.
Ew.
And many patients were becoming addictive. They like marketed these as preventative care to treat anxiety as well as a number of other issues. There's a quote in
holy shit.
They're like, just in case you ever get anxious. It's like, okay. There's a quote in the book that one doctor, that doctors were prescribing tranquilizers for such a comical range of conditions that one physician writing about Valium in a medical journal asked, when do we not use this drug?
Jesus Christ.
So obviously there was a significant amount of prescription writing going on here. And Arthur recognized that selling new drugs requires not just a seduction of the patient, but of the doctor who is writing the prescription. So this is kind of his first foray into convincing doctors that they need to write prescriptions based on what the pharmaceutical companies are suggesting they do. So, yes, very gross. Includes like a lot of medical journal ads, distributing like literature to doctors' offices, getting prominent physicians on board for their campaigns to influence other doctors. Like all of the like kind of expected marketing ploys that you may see in like a lot of other areas, but now they're doing them to get doctors to write prescriptions that are going to change your body's chemistry, right? Like, in ways that just the stakes are so high. Arthur also has this like very bizarre outlook on doctors. Like he himself is a doctor, his brothers are doctors. He basically views doctors as unimpeachable and like could do no wrong.
Oh my god. Spoken like a true white man. Jesus.
So like he has this quote where he says doctors would never be seduced into believing false advertising. And it's like, okay, well, first of all, there's so many different conflicts of interest here. I'm almost like, do they cancel each other out? Because it's like, you're a doctor, and so you have a good view of doctors, but also it's clear that you know what you're doing is not correct, and you're still doing it, and you're just trying to find a way to make doctors feel better about the fact that you're manipulating them.
Well, it's also like, are you writing false advertising and then being like, doctors would never fall for false advertising? So it's like...
Yeah. Literally.
But you want them to fall for it, right? Because that's how you're making money.
But they are. Yeah.
And then they are falling for
so
it.
So he's like...
And then you're like, I'm not doing anything wrong. Like, I don't know. That's, wow, the mental gymnastics.
Yeah, there's a lot going on in that sentence. So, and, you know, this is an important cultural shift that, like, people were expecting to be able to trust their doctors. And so here he is exploiting this societal perception that doctors can be trusted.
So crazy.
Crazy. And so we're going to like have that come up multiple different times throughout this conversation. There's also a moral panic right now in America in 1973 over drugs. Which tended to focus on like street drugs and who is or is not smoking weed, playing on fears about minority groups, immigrants, and illicit influences. Stop me if you've heard this before, Trump. And the idea that you could get hooked on a pill that was prescribed to you by a physician in a white coat with a stethoscope around his neck and a diploma
smoking a cigarette
was somewhat new.
Yeah, yes, no.
Always smoking a cigarette.
Totally. It's just like so funny because
maybe he's
like,
also smoking marijuana.
Yeah. It's just like that's it's I don't know. I know this was all kind of around the same time, but it's like they used to like tell pregnant women to smoke because it was like good for the baby or whatever, you know? And it's like, wow.
Because it was like a fun time for the baby.
Yeah, like they're having a little ciggy break. So I guess it's I'm like coming to it with my understanding now of like what medical advice was back in the day and being like, why would you trust a single fucking word? But that wasn't obviously how they felt about it then because they didn't know that. I mean, I maintain that like people did know that smoking was bad. They were just like clinging on to it for dear life because they were also addicted. But yeah. Okay. Anyway, continue.
I mean, it is very difficult, right? As someone in 2024 to be looking back and saying, oh, right, there was a time in which people had as much trust in a mortgage mm-hmm. or in a doctor or in the president as they would have in anyone. Mm-hmm. And that is simply not true anymore because of all of the things that we talked about at the top of this episode, yeah. right? Like trust in institutions has degraded so much yeah. that it's almost
for good
feels
reason.
Impossible. Yeah. And it almost feels impossible to imagine that it wasn't always this way. Yeah,
totally.
So obviously doctors are human.
Yeah. Turns out.
Need to announce that. and the notion that donning a white coat might somehow shield them from temptation is a fantasy. Mm-hmm. Let me just share this. And this is jumping ahead a little bit, but it's a insight into what we'll talk about later. Mm-hmm. A 2016 study found that purchasing even a single meal with a value of $20 for a physician can be enough to change the way that he prescribes. Ah. So that's like a Chipotle bowl.
Oh my God. And that's in like today-ish money?
That was 2016.
Okay, yeah. So that's not like 1970 money.
Yeah. To be clear, that's a 2016 study yeah. that found
so
that.
It's like actually $20, not $200,
yeah.
which is what it was like back in, I don't know, yeah. you know, but still, even if it was yeah, $500, even if it was, that is not enough. That is not enough money to change.
It's not enough money that should change your morals.
Jesus Christ.
Some years, Purdue Pharma would allocate as much as $9 million just to buy food for doctors.
Oh my God. I am so distressed.
Like some of these things I just have to pause after because it's like one sentence, but it's so damning.
It's so damning.
That it's like, how could you ever claim that you have no culpability in this situation?
Oh my God. It's also just like, it obviously it is not an individual doctor's fault, but it's just like the reason they allocated $9 million was because it was working that effectively and they were making so much more than $9 million that it was worth spending $9 million on that. Like that is
yes.
chilling.
Yeah.
God.
It's pretty wild.
Ugh.
So, okay, I'm going to skip over some of the additional conflict of interest things here because, frankly, there are just so many.
Okay.
But Arthur Sackler became, like, a publisher of a medical journal. he became a publisher of a medical journal. Okay. And he would, like, put his own ads in the medical journal, and it's just like, okay, buddy, like this is such God. A clear conflict of interest.
So wild.
In 1959, it emerged that a company that he owned had paid the chief of the antibiotics division of the FDA nearly $300,000 in exchange for his help in promoting certain drugs. Mm. So, like, once again, the scandal runs deep mm-hmm. here. We're like getting into the FDA, which is allegedly the government-funded organization that's supposed to be protecting you from these sorts of yeah. things. And there's corruption within mm-hmm. that organization that was contributing directly to this as well.
Yeah. Ugh. Well, and as you've said, like, okay, maybe these guys seem to start out with like no noble causes in mind, but very quickly we have gotten to a point where they're like, no way that they didn't know that this was like really a problem.
100%.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, I slipped this in because we have to briefly touch on this. Arthur was also an avid art collector, and he began a history of donating to museums around the world. He donated. Have you've been to the Met,
Oh,
right?
yeah.
Okay. Have you ever been to the temple part of the Met? It's in like the Egyptian.
No, I don't think I got into that section. I like started to
It's
walk through
such
there
a
and then,
huge museum, so I like even if you've been to the Met, you may not have been to, that part. He donated $3.5 million to the Met to build that temple, which was a recreation of an Egyptian pyramid.
Boo.
And he was like celebrated for his generosity, but really it was an exercise in family branding. So the truth ended up being that because the Sacklers had negotiated to pay their donation of $3.5 million over 20 years, when it came time to actually build the wing, the Met did not have enough cash on hand to do it.
Oh my God.
And so they were forced to raise more funds, and the city ended up chipping in like $1.4 million.
God. And like, I know for a long time the Sacklers' names were all over lots of museums in New York and maybe elsewhere. But
All over.
wasn't, didn't they? I thought they had started to take those names down in the recent years.
Yeah, there's a number of museums that got enough pressure that they started to take the Sackler name off of specific wings or galleries that they had donated to. I think a really big example is the Tate in London. They got a ton of protests that happened where they were pressured to do that. I actually don't know if the Met still attributes this gallery to the Sacklers or not. I would have to double check on that one, but I know they definitely got pressure to not.
Yeah, totally.
Whether or not they like actually followed through with it is questionable.
Yeah.
Okay, so in 1987, Arthur died, and his one third of the company was bought by his still living brothers.
Okay.
So the business was renamed as Purdue Pharma.
Okay.
Arthur's heirs ended up selling their shares for $22 million, which sounds like a lot, but in light of what the company was about to become, not really.
Yeah.
So the biggest players in the second generation of Sacklers is Richard, who is the son of Raymond,
Okay.
and Kath, who is the daughter of Mortimer.
Okay.
So the two brothers who didn't die first, that like were directly in charge of the pharmaceutical, their son and daughter respectively, are the biggest players in the second generation.
Okay, got it. The biggest sacks of shit in
Richard,
the second generation.
the biggest sacks of Sackler shit. Richard was trained as a doctor, but always intended to take over the family business. It was like never
Okay,
a
it was like a
guess that he was
fake
actually going to be.
degree.
Yeah, it was like, okay, you got a degree, but like you're not going to use it
Yeah.
for that purpose. He was never a serious medical student, in other words. And he joined Purdue Pharma in 1971 as an assistant to his daddy and then worked his way up. Okay. So I want to take a pause and talk about the history of opium.
Okay, I'm excited.
So we talked a little bit about the Sacklers. Big takeaway is bad.
Boo.
Very clearly collapsing the boundaries between a lot of different disciplines in order to benefit themselves. I think it's the biggest takeaway.
Yes.
So let's talk about opium.
Okay. Dun dun dun.
So opium comes from the poppy plant and has been cultivated for 5,000 years. This has been around for a very long time in human history, longer than the earth, if you're a creationist. And
What a sick, sick
there's
burn.
I'm sorry, I did have to throw that in. So there's this great book called Opium, A History, by Martin Booth, and I read it a few years ago. At this point, it's outdated because it does not include the recent history of the opioid crisis. So I think he wrote it in like 1998 or something.
Okay. Yeah.
So
blissfully like, unaware of what hell was to come.
Of what to come. Yeah. But he kind of explains like the contentious history that humankind was with opium. Mm-hmm. But like in a nutshell, humans have always been aware of the powers and the consequences, including the addictive powers of opium for centuries. This is not a surprise. No one should be surprised. So one example is like the Civil War in America. Mm-hmm. Soldiers were treated for pain with morphine and they became addicted. So like during the American Civil War, morphine was widely embraced and it produced a generation of veterans who came home after the war addicted to the drug. Mm-hmm. By one estimate, in 1898, 250,000 Americans were addicted to morphine.
Oh, that is so many.
Which makes sense because those wars were grisly and a lot of people lost limbs and had other physical ailments after.
Well, and like emotional trauma that is like hard to cope with.
And like there is not a good treatment for pain.
Yeah.
You know, like there just isn't. This is, morphine was the best thing they could do. And it just happened to be something that also caused addiction if you were using it repeatedly.
Yeah.
Bayer, B-A-Y-E-R, the company that has aspirin, invented heroin and marketed it as a solution to morphine addiction.
Nice. Worse addiction as a solution for an addiction. Great. It is effective. I must say.
Fucking nailed it.
God.
So oxycodone was developed by Germans in 1916.
Okay. They were like, we have some big things ahead, so let's prepare.
Yeah, we're just gonna, let's prepare, let's get it on the lines, and stockpile as much as we can.
Holy shit. Okay, dark.
Extremely. So, in the 1970s, we're just gonna skip over both the World War situations.
Can't do all of it in this episode.
No, we can't do all the bleak things in human history. So in the late 1970s, a morphine pill was created.
Okay.
This was a huge deal. Okay. This is a direct quote. In the late 1970s, NAP produced a new product that was genuinely innovative, a morphine pill. The company had been prompted to do so by a hospice in London called St. Christopher's, which is run by Cicely Saunders, a crusading physician who had written a book called Care of the Dying and pioneered a new palliative care movement, arguing that the medical establishment should provide a more compassionate environment for terminally ill patients to die in. Mm. So what we're talking about here is that this was invented for people who were
dying
at the end of their lives. Yeah. And they needed comfort and they didn't deserve to die in pain.
Yeah.
And that is a huge deal to be able to gift someone a lack of pain in their last moments, I think is incredibly admirable.
Yeah.
What we decided to do with it afterwards, maybe not as much, right?
Yeah.
There's another quote in here. That's directly from Mortimer's daughter, Kath, where she says, MS Cotton really was an incredible medicine because it allowed cancer patients particularly not to have to be hospitalized to have their pain treated. Mm. So what you're gifting them to is more time out of the hospital so they can be with their families in those moments, which is very meaningful.
Yeah.
Okay. So during the 1980s, Raymond and Mortimer Sackler had great success at Purdue with an innovative painkiller called MS Cotton.
Okay.
So this is a morphine pill with a patented, quote-unquote, controlled release formula, which means that the drug dissolved gradually into the bloodstream over several hours.
Hmm.
Cotton is short for continuous.
Mm.
So what's happening is that you take the pill, and because it is gradually dissolved into your bloodstream, it gives you longer pain management than you otherwise would have.
Mm-hmm.
So it's very innovative. huge deal that this comes out.
Yeah.
It generated $170 million in a single year in sales.
Wow.
So it was immediately something that was prescribed and used a lot. So at this point, we are up to the 1990s. Okay. In 1990, Richard Sackler became aware of that MS Cotton was going to face generic competition soon because their patent is expiring.
Okay.
So there is this truly horrendous process that pharmaceutical companies go through called evergreening, which allows the original patent holder to introduce some minor tweak to the product and thereby obtain a new patent for that drug so that it cannot be made into a generic, which means it cannot be sold for cheaper and they have no competition.
Oh my God.
So through this process, what they're basically doing is creating a false monopoly for themselves. Mm-hmm. And this happens with all kinds of drugs. But specifically here, it's MS Cotton.
Okay.
So they understand that like MS Cotton is about to face generic competition. They need to do something in order to keep a hold on the market. And their solution is OxyContin.
Okay.
So in 1996, Purdue Pharma introduces OxyContin on the market. This is a reformulated version of oxycodone. But this time, the slow-release formula that they claimed would... they're doing it with this slow-release formula that they claims will prevent the use of the drug because the effects released over a period of time versus it being like a quick hit to someone's system.
And that's what oxycodone is. It's like a big rush.
Yeah. So oxycodone, I think was made into a pill, but you have to take it more often is my understanding.
Okay.
Because it basically does not allow your body to metabolize it over time.
Okay. Got it. So you get it and it goes through your system and then you have to take it again. And you're taking more of it.
Or you're getting it through, like, an IV drip.
Oh,
right?
Yeah. Okay.
Like,
okay,
for
it,
those, like, dying patients.
Yes. Okay, okay, okay. So this is, like, a more effective pill form.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. So...
And wait, so what you were saying was that the cotton for OxyContin is meant to be continuous release, but was there, like, a but to that?
Yes. Okay. Which is that even though it is a continuous release, it does not prevent abuse.
Oh, okay.
which they claimed that it did.
Okay, right. That's
so importantly, before OxyContin is actually released on the market, the FDA it has to go through an FDA examination process. Mm-hmm. The examiner who oversaw the process of approval for US markets, Dr. Curtis Wright, left the agency shortly afterward in 1995, and within 2 years, he had taken a job at Purdue Pharma.
Oh, my God.
So, how strenuous was that examination process?
Mm.
Probably not as strenuous as it needed to be.
Right.
So, this pill was originally introduced in a 10-milligram pill,
okay,
which is, you know, fairly small on the small side. But it was also introduced up to 80 milligrams.
Whoa.
And then a whopping 160 milligram.
Oh my God.
Which the potency exceeded that of many prescription opioids on the market.
Jeez.
According to the company, there was no maximum daily dose or ceiling dose.
What the fuck?
So they're basically saying you can take 160 milligrams every 12 hours. That's fine. We're not that worried about it.
Oh, my God. We're not that worried about it because the more you take, the more money we make. So.
Yeah.
Why basically. Would we cap it?
Why would we? Why would we care?
Yeah.
So in the first year, Purdue sold $44 million of OxyContin. The following year, sales more than doubled.
Oh, no.
The year after that, they doubled again.
Mm.
This is a direct quote. I am pleased to report sales through September of 1999, year to date, of $601 million.
Oh my God.
So that's in 1999. So that was Michael Friedman wrote to Richard, Raymond, and Mortimer Sackler, noting that OxyContin prescription trends continue to accelerate.
Okay. Gross.
Okay. So that is, we talked about the Sacklers.
Yeah.
We talked about opium. The important thing here is that while opium has always been around, they introduced a more efficient way of taking it, and they introduced it at a higher volume, mm-hmm. which they then pushed to markets in order to sell as much as possible.
Mm-hmm. Knowing all the while that it was, in fact, addictive, despite their claim that it was not going to cause a habitual use.
Correct. Yeah. Because they, I mean, we don't have, like, maybe...
Total proof of this,
but they probably skirted a lot of the FDA evaluation of the drug.
Yes. Okay.
So now I want to talk about the sales. They have this miracle pill.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah.
So, well, maybe you're about to get into it, but, like, is there in their marketing of OxyContin, did they say in the marketing materials that it wasn't habit forming? Oh my God.
What a fantastic question. This is exactly what I'm about to talk about. Okay.
Fuck these people.
So let's get into the sales. Again, pause. Fuck these people. Right? Okay. We'll just say that multiple times throughout this episode. So there's a push to prescribe this for everything. Small and large pain management, continuous and short-lived, right? You have a headache, OxyContin. You have chronic back pain, OxyContin. You broke your leg, OxyContin, right? So this is a quote from the book. If a doctor was already treating a patient with another painkiller, the sales reps would persuade the doctor to switch to OxyContin. Even in cases where the painkiller the doctor was already prescribing was Purdue's own MS Cotton, the reps would counsel to switching to Oxy. The Sacklers' commitment to the new product was so absolute that they were prepared to phase out their old product. Wow. In the first 4 years of the 1990s, morphine consumption in the United States rose by 75%. Oof. So they basically are like, everyone should use it, and they should use it for everything. So that is their stance as a company, as they're pushing their salespeople out.
Right.
And I will answer your question about how they were dealing with the potential of addiction.
But I now have a different question.
I know you have another question. Yeah, go ahead. Ask.
So was or is OxyContin, it sounds like it's more addictive than MS Cotton.
Yes, I would say slightly.
Okay.
So, and the reason why is basically that, it was very easy for people to get addicted because of the way that doctors were prescribing OxyContin.
Okay. And it had no cap of like milligram dosage. So it kind of, it was like,
so you could be prescribed way more than you needed. But it was also very easy to abuse, which includes like grinding up the pills and snorting mm-hmm. them, dissolving them in liquid and injecting them, all of the various different ways that you could like
gross
get this into your body.
Ooh, okay. Got it.
So the company is, company memos recorded that they are pushing broadening the drug to a wide array of use cases. Mm-hmm. Sales reps were trained in overcoming objections and encouraged to sell by any means necessary. This is a quote from the book. There were 10 of them, all salespeople for Purdue. At the top of the sheet, the insider had written toppers. It was the top 10 sales reps in the country. Next to the name of each rep was the name of a place, his or her sales region. If you were to look up these regions, the source told Meyer, every district that is represented on that list is a hotspot for OxyContin abuse.
Oh my God.
So you have these top salespeople directly correlating to hotspots for OxyContin addiction.
I wonder why.
The regions, exactly. the regions where the problem began often had large numbers of people who were out of work or who worked hard manual labor jobs, people who were disabled and chronically ill, people who were suffering from pain. In some cases, these communities also happen to have longstanding problems with prescription drug use. So in some parts of Appalachia, people would pair an OxyContin with a Valium, one of Richard Sackler's pills, and one of Uncle Arthur's, and they called this the Cadillac High.
Oh, dear God.
So now we're starting to see not just the impact of Richard Sackler and OxyContin, but like that this is a multi-generational problem that they have created and pushed for their own benefit.
And like and made it worse by layering on top of their original problems.
Yes.
Yep. Cool.
Because why not? Yeah.
Well, we're terrible, soulless creeps, so might as well be rich, I guess. Jesus.
I guess. But at least we donate to the Met. So Purdue paid thousands of clinicians to attend medical conferences and deliver presentations about the merits of the drugs. Doctors were offered all expenses paid trips to pain management seminars in places like Boca Raton. They advertised this in medical journals. This is once again, like Arthur's playbook, right? Mm-hmm. Like they're just repeating this, but like 10 times more aggressively. Mm-hmm. Within 5 years of introduction, OxyContin alone was generating $1 billion a year. Mm-hmm. And this is like $1 billion a year for the company just for this one drug.
Mm-hmm. Damn.
So the Sackler Empire is a completely integrated operation. They develop a drug, they have it clinically tested, secure favorable reports from the doctors and hospitals, which they had connections, devise an advertising campaign for their agency, publish the clinical articles and the advertisements in their own medical journals, and then use their public relations muscle to place articles in newspapers and magazines.
Classic.
So they have integrated themselves into each piece of this puzzle in order to be able to control the narrative around their own drug.
Yeah.
Okay.
Oof.
How are we feeling?
Oh, just like completely disgusted, you know?
Yes.
Ugh. I do. Jesus. Well, the other thing I was thinking about too is like you cited how a lot of the hotspots happened in places where people are essentially like blue collar, low income, like a poverty scale, probably like a disproportionately non-white. But not, that isn't to say that, like, I think there might be statistics that white people were affected more by this, but okay, you're not.
Yeah, it is, it's interesting because racism still plays a role here, but maybe not the role you'd think.
Okay.
This is like when two lesbians would be living together in like 1901 and they would be like, well, they're two women.
They're friends.
They need a man to have sex.
Oh, yeah.
So they can live together.
Yes.
Because women can't have sex with each other. Right. Yeah. And it's like, okay, like, well, that's
laughing all the way to the bank.
Right. And it's like, well, that's prejudice, but it actually benefited
so
them.
So this was, they were not weirdly getting prescribed as much.
Correct. Okay. So, and the reason for that, is that, hold on, let me find this in my note. African Americans had been spared the full brunt of the opioid epidemic because doctors were less likely to prescribe opioid painkillers to black patients, either because they did not trust them to take the drugs responsibly, which no one was taking them responsibly, or because they were less likely to feel empathy for their pain.
Right. Okay.
Which is racism.
Terrible. Yeah. Okay.
So, yeah.
So
it's like, it did primarily affect white people, not to say that it didn't affect African Americans at all, but it was for racist reasons as well.
So interesting. But anyway, the point I was going to make was that, like, when you're talking about areas like that, low income, like, a lot of hardship, and, like, you know, families that are struggling for, like, addiction and other reasons, there's a lot of, like, emotional pain that's happening too. And kind of like what I said with the Civil War, it's like, part of what is so addictive is that it's not just soothing physical pain, it's also soothing emotional pain. And that is such a, like, terrible combination to try to get yourself out of.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And I think he says this at some point during the book, but, like, part of the problem here is that there's no good way to treat chronic pain. Mm-hmm. And like, there's not some miracle alternative that you can say, like, okay, we're going to tell you have to get off Oxycontin, but then like, mm-hmm. then what?
Yeah.
Then I just have to be in pain all the time, yeah. you know? So like, there's also not a perfect alternative to lead people to mm-hmm. after you tell them that they can't have this anymore.
Yeah. Yes. Which makes getting off of it that much harder because they know that getting off of it leads to like a life of pain.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. So this is a quote about the addiction process here. Okay. So if you ground the pills up and snorted them or dissolved them in liquid and injected them, you could override the time release mechanism and deliver a huge narcotic payload all at once. Perversely, users could learn about such methods by reading a warning label that came with each prescription, which said, quote, taking broken, chewed, or crushed Oxycontin tablets could lead to the rapid release and absorption of a potentially toxic dose, end quote.
Oh my God.
So on the packaging, they're saying, you're going to be fine, but just like, don't take it wrong. And here's the way that you would do that mm-hmm. if you did want to high all at once.
Yeah. Oh my God. And that cool. It's like every addict knows that their drug could kill them and that isn't enough to stop them. So just saying that like it could be a potentially lethal dose is like, okay.
Duck shit. Like, who cares? What? What? How is that helpful here?
Oh, God.
The problem is not that no one doesn't know the consequences of drugs.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Like, that's totally. Not the problem.
Yeah. 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 The problem is that has never been enough to stop addiction. It's not a lack of
knowledge.
Addiction. Yeah.
Okay. So eventually, they released a tamper-resistant pill that was harder to crush. Mm. You could slam one of the pills with a hammer and it would crack, but it wouldn't shatter. You could also like try to pry it into pieces, but if you tried to snort the bits that broke off, they'd get like stuck in your nostril. So basically they like released this tamper in the hopes that this meant that it would slow down rates of addiction. But the problem is that they released this in 2010. Okay. It's
way too fucking late.
Yeah. This had already been on the market for you had already done the damage you were going to do. And you have mm-hmm. a ton of people who have already discovered the powers of this drug. And so to release it in mm-hmm. now is essentially useless. You were already in the midst of a full blown epidemic at that point.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. Yeah. And at that point, people are desperate enough to figure out a way around something like that. You know, maybe that, like you said, it might have slowed down this sort of thing if it had been introduced immediately, because it would have been harder for people to like be creative about how to absorb yeah. it so fast. But once they know the benefit, they're going to figure out a way to do it
yeah.
no matter what you do. Yeah,
exactly.
Or, as I'm sure you're going to get to, they just go start taking heroin.
Yes, yeah.
You know?
On that note.
So stupid.
Yeah, people who took heroin often developed a craving for it, and because the body develops a tolerance for the drug over time, the user tended to require ever stronger doses in order to feel a sense of equilibrium. So this is true of all opioids. As the body grows accustomed to the drug, it becomes necessary to administer more of it in order to relieve the pain, deliver euphoria, or just stave off withdrawal, right? So if you were prescribed maybe the 10 milligram pill, at some point you're going to have to go up in dosage, or you're going to have to go up right. in the amount of times you're taking it per day, or both.
Mm-hmm.
So Purdue never acknowledged the addiction risk or pulled the drug from the shelves. One reporter asked Raymond Sackler if he felt any personal responsibility for the tragedy, and he replied, absolutely not. In a mid-year update to the Sacklers in June 2016, staffers told the family that according to surveys, nearly half of all Americans knew someone who had been addicted to prescription opioids. At a meeting in early 2011, staff showed the board data indicating that 83% of patients who were admitted to substance abuse treatment centers had started using opioids by swallowing them in pill form. So, you know, it's not necessarily that like 83% of these patients were prescribed opioids. It could be that they had taken
Right.
them from an aunt, an uncle, a friend, a
Friend or
grandmother who
whatever.
was prescribed them. But when you put
Right.
this many pills on the market and everybody has easy access to them, you are opening up the doors for rampant abuse.
Totally. I've like had the experience of being prescribed. I don't know if it was OxyContin. I can never remember because you know there's a few that are like kind of similar. But there was like one time I had a root canal done, and at the same time I had a kidney stone, which was like, wow, what a great time I was fucking having, you know? But I would like I had had treatment for the kidney stone. It was like I was managing the pain and I forget whatever I was taking. I think it was just ibuprofen, like a high dose of that. And when I was at the doctor for the root canal, I like had said like I was on these medications for the fucking kidney stone, and they were like, "Oh my God, do you want us to prescribe you like an opioid?" Basically, they asked me if I wanted that prescription, and it was just like, "You don't fucking know anything about me. Like, what if I have an addiction?" And you're just like, you know, or like you're not treating that for me at all. Why would you offer to write me a prescription for an opioid that's like so addictive? It's crazy. But I've had like that experience more than once where I got a prescription for an opioid that was like very non-commensurate with what I was going through.
For sure. And again, it like goes back to like, yeah, if you're prescribing it for anything and everything, like it's not that hard to get.
Yeah.
I mean, I know multiple people who have been prescribed opioids and then decided not to take them because they were scared of the potential impact.
Yeah,
I
totally.
mean, yeah. It feels like at this point in time, we were all just like one bad injury away from becoming addicted. Like any, this could have happened to
Wait,
anyone,
right.
and it did happen to a
Right.
ton of people
So many people.
through no
Well,
fault of
that's
their
the thing.
own.
Like I was lucky that like the things that I had, and I have taken opioids, but it's like the things I took it for was like a short-term issue that, you know, was able to be resolved. And you know, I was being cautious, but that doesn't mean that you wouldn't get addicted if you were taking it for a long time. So you're totally right. It's
Yeah, I mean,
crazy.
especially when you start talking about chronic pain, it's like, you know,
Yeah. Oh my God. Yeah.
that is, there's a
That
reason
there's
why
no
it's called
solution
chronic,
for.
right? Like, it's not gonna just go
Yeah.
away on its own. Yeah.
Totally.
So at the same time, as time goes on here, there also starts to be an uptick in crime related to drug use, right? So around 2000, the company was notified of an OxyContin thief. In the spring of
Oh, jeez.
2000, Richard was emailed about an OxyContin thief who was hitting pharmacies in Ohio. And they said that there was a story out of Maine and one from Florida, but they were isolated. But in Ohio, this is happening like almost every month. And so they start to get like these reports that, you know, people are coming in to steal this very valuable prescription drug. Patrick Rodden Keefe also cites the book Dreamland, which is really on the same kind of subject, where that author had described the manner in which at this time drug syndicates in Mexico were sensing an emerging market in the United States and began smuggling unprecedented volumes of cheap heroin into the country. And I think I already talked about this part. Yeah. So, you know, there's like obviously the tragedy of addiction, there's the tragedy of death that's happening here. And then there are all of these like sort of side consequences that are happening, like theft of pharmacies and heroin drug sellers that are coming in and realizing that there's now an emerging market in the United States for that. And like all of these things that have just unraveled exponentially because of what happened with OxyContin.
Yeah. And now, isn't it like I cannot remember what fentanyl is being mixed with, but it's with heroin, isn't it? Or am I
I think
wrong?
there are reports of it being mixed with a lot of different things.
Okay.
But I think it's.
But it's like they use fentanyl to cut drugs, right? And it like 'cause it provides its own sort of high, but it is like much more deadly then okay,
significantly.
So yeah, that I feel like that problem is like a direct result of it too, because it's like, you know, and that's what's killing a lot of people.
Yeah,
now.
Because you have to keep going up in intensity in order for that to give you the same benefits, or again, even just like stave off withdrawal.
Right. And if you're getting it from, you know, dealers on the street or what have you, you don't really know what's in it. And so you're like kind of guessing on the dosage and then you, you know, you get like more fentanyl than you realize or whatever. And it's like game over.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
I only have one little section left, which is kind of how Purdue Pharma was talking about its patients and the abuse that's going on. So they always basically claimed that the abuse is on the patients, that if it's claiming that if it's taken as intended, it's perfectly safe and it doesn't cause addiction. They claimed that if the drug was being taken as directed, people wouldn't be addicted, and that Purdue marketed Oxy as a twice a day drug. The relief supposedly was supposed to last 12 hours. So you take it two times a day, but in their medical trials, roughly half the patients required another dose before 12 hours were up. So this claim was a valuable marketing tool, but prescribing a pill on a 12-hour schedule, when for many patients it works only for 8, is a recipe for withdrawal, addiction, and abuse.
Yeah.
In fact, many people who were prescribed the drug for legitimate pain conditions took it precisely as the doctor ordered, but found that they too had become hopelessly addicted. Prescribing a pill on a 12-hour schedule when it only works on 8 creates what they call peaks and troughs, which is basically this phenomenon that happens when you are using the drug and then it is working for you because you just took it, and then it goes into the troughs, which is kind of like a mini withdrawal, so you take more. And Purdue's sales reps claimed that OxyContin avoided this because of the time release patent, but it didn't, because people were not using it that way, right?
Well, it also, it's like, would it matter either way? Like, if someone, like you said, people were taking it as prescribed, and it's like they were taking it every 12 hours, but the point is not like, oh, if you only take it every 12 hours, you won't get addicted. It's like the amount of time that you're taking it for. And if people are taking it for chronic pain, then they're going to get addicted no matter what.
Right.
Like, even if you took one every 24 hours, I feel like that would cause addiction.
If you take one every 24 hours for a month, you're going to start to need that, right? Like, So,
It's like, the point is that it's addictive, and that's why it's addictive. Like, what the fuck?
Like, you don't get out of it because you're just making stuff up. So by 2001, the company knew that 20% of all OxyContin prescriptions were being written on a more frequent dosing schedule than 12 hours, which should have been an indication to them that what they had created was a recipe for addiction.
Right, because like, as people take it, it's less effective, so they have to take more of it. So that's like, the doctors are giving them, because they need to take it every 4 hours instead of every 8 or whatever.
And instead of like, pulling it from the shelves and investigating until they figured out what was going on exactly, if they didn't already know, which they did, they did nothing. They just reaped the benefits.
Well, great.
Great. Good call. So eventually there are lawsuits that included state and federal lawsuits filed against Purdue Pharma seeking compensation for the costs incurred during the opioid epidemic. The lawsuits alleged that the Sackler family was fully aware of their deceptive marketing practices and continued to profit from the sales when they knew it led to addiction. In 2007, the company pleaded guilty to misleading advertising campaigns and paid fines. And then from like 2010 to 2018, there were various states, including I think Ohio, that brought charges against the company and the Sackler family individually. Purdue Pharma then filed for bankruptcy in 2019. And in October of 2020, Purdue Pharma pleaded guilty to criminal charges as a part of a settlement with the U.S. Department of Justice. And both the company and the family had fines that they were required to pay.
Wasn't this the one that the Supreme Court was like deciding about whether or not this company could declare bankruptcy to like get out of the criminal charges or something to that effect?
Good question. I don't know. Maybe.
I thought this was like... Maybe it's just related, but I thought it was the Sackler family, that it was like the Supreme Court was deciding on whether or not they could declare bankruptcy in order to like stave off additional criminal charges or something like that. And I remember it was like the decision would kind of set a precedent for whether or not, and maybe it was like, maybe it was another drug company, so I'm getting it confused, but
It definitely
anyway,
could have
sorry.
been Purdue Pharma. I admittedly did less research into the lawsuits that were involved here just because they were complicated and they.
Yeah, that's like a whole other book, you know?
Yeah, and also, like, yes, they had to pay fines, but ultimately, there's pretty much nothing that would
Yeah, they haven't really.
be a commensurate consequence for them for their actions. So,
And they're still like obscenely wealthy. Like that's how that stuff works. Like,
So basically, like,
oh
yes,
God.
they did, there were federal and state lawsuits, but I mean, it's not like that makes it all better, right? So.
No, my God, no.
So,
Yeah, even like them going to prison for the rest of their lives wouldn't make it all better. You know, it's one of those
yeah.
things that wouldn't, and it obviously it wouldn't make it better, but it's like that wouldn't even be an appropriate
Yeah.
punishment for what
Yeah.
they've done.
Yeah. So, all right. I'm at the end of this tragic story. How are you feeling now? What are you thinking about?
I was just thinking about how sometimes, like, okay, do you know the comedian Eddie Izzard?
That name sounds really
I think
familiar,
that's
yeah.
how. Well, also, she might go by a different name now. She is trans,
Okay.
and I believe that is how she identifies now. I'm not sure. But anyway, they have a joke that is about how when someone is a murderer, we're like, wow, that's terrible. But once you become like a mass murderer, it's like our brains stop being able to
Yeah.
comprehend it. And they make a joke about like Pol Pot, and where she makes a joke about Pol Pot, and it's like, it's almost like you're congratulating them. Like, good
Yeah.
job. You must get up very early in the morning. I can't even get to the gym, you know, that sort of thing. And I was thinking about how like this kind of crime is like that in our society. We're almost like it's so inconceivably terrible what they've done that we kind of like, well, there's no punishment. We don't know what to do. We might as well just leave them alone. And it's like, I wish there was something
Yeah.
more that we had other than just being like, wow, that was really bad.
Yeah, for
You
sure.
know?
And it's like, okay, yeah, I guess they paid fines and Purdue Pharma does not operate the way that it used to. But like, it's not as if the family or they the
Well, and
company lost
OxyContin is.
everything, you know? Like,
No, or like barely anything in the
yeah, I mean,
scheme
it's
of
like you
things. And also, isn't OxyContin still
Yeah, I
sold?
mean, I think it's still in the market. It's more it, I think it's difficult more difficult to get, but it doesn't it's not like it was completely pulled from the markets or anything. Although it is now sold with that like tamper resistant treatment or whatever, which makes it more difficult to abuse if that's what you're trying to do.
Well, sorry. What were you gonna say? I feel like I cut you off.
No, I don't remember.
Okay,
No, I
I'm
think that was
sorry.
it. I think I was just agreeing with you that these people suck.
Well, I think we should say, yeah, one more time. Fuck
Say it
these
with us.
people. Ugh. Yeah.
Wherever you are right now, say it with
God.
us. Fuck the Sacklers.
Yeah. Jeez. You know, I don't know that I believe in things like heaven and hell, but boy, I hope they burn in hell, you
No
know?
kidding. I mean, that would be the least of their punishments.
Yeah.
Yeah, I
Oh.
think,
Jeez.
you know, I think it's important to, like, yes, of course, this is a very bleak story, but I also think it's important to talk about the structures that are exposed here and how, on each level, the protections for individuals fell apart. And that was like starting from the first generation of Sacklers and how they were using marketing in doctor's offices, all the way through to the corruption within the FDA, to the sales reps of the company. Like, this was a massive, massive machine that ruined a lot of people's lives. And it is astounding that things can happen on this scale. and I think with relative quickness, like as you think about the the massive impact this had in a 2-decade period.
Yeah. Yeah, and like continues to have, because people like are still addicted to it. I mean, hopefully, as I don't know what's going to happen, but I hope that like as that drug is prescribed less and doctors understand the real consequence, that over time the people that are still addicted to, you know, morphine, fentanyl, all of that, like eventually the curve starts to come down again. But it's like nothing changes the people who died and the families that were destroyed because of that.
Absolutely. Well, thank you for letting me talk about this light and airy topic.
I bet you feel like a weight is lifted off of you now that you've you're done with it, though.
Well, because I wanted to do this not just because, like I mentioned, it's an important story, but also because I love Patrick Rodden Keefe. I think he's an excellent and extremely talented journalist. I read his other book called Say Nothing, which was about the Troubles in Ireland, which was also incredible. He had a book that came out in, I think, 2023 that was called Rogues, and it's a compilation of his articles that he's written for the New Yorker over the years that are specifically about mostly rich people doing crazy things. There's one like article he wrote about like badly. Wine and wine collectors and how they're like often getting like taken advantage of because they don't actually know what they're doing, and it's very easy to fake. Which is interesting. Anyway, I think he is really great at his job, and I wanted to do at least one of his books for this. So if you are interested, I would recommend reading anything by him.
Nice. Well, you did an excellent job.
Thank you. Now I need to go and take a nap.
I feel informed and dismayed.
Informed, dismayed, depressed, distressed. And ultimately ready for a nap.
So ready. Well, thank you, everyone. We hope to see you next time, or we hope to be listened to you next time. I don't know. Something like that.
We hope to talk to you next time.
Okay, bye.